It's a civil war within Congress. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
It's great to be back with you, Barry. Once again, we show that Central Ohio is an interesting place having to do with weather.
Being in the 50s and 60s one day and having an inch and a half of snow and in the 20s the next.
Yeah, really. 2 day separation between 60 and tonight it's going to be about 13 degrees here. So welcome to Central Ohio, ladies and gentlemen, the crossroads of weather.
That's it. Chuck, again, it's February, and the one thing that you can really be positive about in February, well, besides Valentine's Day, if you like that and celebrate it and think that that's a wonderful thing. And, you know, for me, I have a little kind of a sneaky little help in that way, because my wife's birthday is the day before Valentine's Day. So I can just lump it all in together and I'm covered. But anyhow, but, you know, really, there's not a whole lot that goes on in February when it comes to, you know, activities, because, you know, we have weather like this or it's a continual deep freeze. And one of the good things you have to look forward to in February is that by the time we cross mid-February, we are looking at only having another month or so of winter left. Well, and I mean that calendar-wise, not so much activity and the climate-wise. But, you know, we're moving right on in. It's going to be no time, and we're going to be in March, and it's going to be spring is popping. Honestly, with this 60, 70, and we had 70-degree weather down here a couple days ago, down here on the river. I'm looking out here and I'm seeing flowers starting to come up through the ground again. You know, the early daffodils and things of that nature are already starting to pop up through the ground. And I'm afraid that we're going to get another big deep cold snap. And that means we won't have that many flowers this spring.
Yeah, that's the price you pay for some of these warm snaps. There's nothing you can do about it. That's the beauty of it. Despite cries to the contrary that we're in control of the climate, we're not. Nothing we can do about it. Fact is that some years I can remember going out and seeing early spring flowers popping up through the snow, usually in March, sometimes as early as late February. It's a little early. When I lived in southern Indiana, of course, we were 6 weeks earlier down there. I lived in southeastern Indiana for a few years. And, of course, the winters were shorter. I mean, let's be clear about that. I mean, we knew it would be really cold in late December through about mid-February, and then it would start warming up, and that's exactly what happened. So I kind of miss that a little bit. You get a little bit more than that than we get up here. And, of course, the folks further north from here have even longer winters. I also lived in Michigan for 11 years, and let me tell you something. Sometimes you got cold in mid-November, and it didn't warm up again until mid-May or mid-April.
That's true.
And we would get, you know, April up there is when you get your worst snowfalls because the air's a little warmer.
Yes, that's right.
And chock full of moisture. Warm moisture will absorb. The atmosphere carries more moisture when it's warmer. And man, let me tell you, man, when one of those warm things come up from the south and hit the cold air coming down from Lake Superior, you would get a 15 incher very easily. Now the beauty of those things is they don't last. Usually when you get those, they fall and they make life very difficult for about a day, and then it all starts running away. But I can tell you my first experience in Michigan, and this was no fun. Our first year in Michigan, it started snowing before Thanksgiving and did not stop until after Easter. And in fact, what they had to do was they had to pile the snow in the Myers parking lot across the street from us. Yes, that's right, folks. We had a Myers right across the street from us. They piled it, and it was as high as the giant Mercury lights in the parking lot. They actually had to bring in a front loader and to pile it up. The last of the snow did not disappear from the Myers parking lot until Memorial Day weekend.
Oh, that's not a surprise. When you pile it up that deep, that core gets really icy and really just completely blocked up in there. It would take it a while to melt.
I can remember walking over to Myers and coming back and telling my wife, Jenny, I said, well, okay, if you want to see the last of winter, head over to Myers in the next hour because it's going to be gone. And sure enough, the last little bit of ice just ran down the storm drain.
Absolutely. And I remember just last year, it was the second weekend in March, and I know this for a fact because I was going up to present at the Bringing America Back to Life conference at Cleveland Right to Life hosts. And as a matter of fact, they're doing that again this year. Shameless plug, it's on March 10th and the 11th, I think, or 11th and 12th. It's that weekend. And I'm going to be up there again doing some breakout sessions on end-of-life issues. But this last year, I remember we left a little early. My wife went with me and traveled, and our children stayed with my parents. And we left, and as we got to Columbus, there was some reports, and we knew there was something coming in of snow starting to fall. And so we did some stuff, and I think we spent that night in Columbus, and then we drove on up to Cleveland the next day. And, as you got farther north, it was beautiful. You know, it was nice. It was slightly, warmer than usual. It was clear. Everything was great. Had a fantastic weekend. Drove back down to when we got down to, close to home, found out that after we had left on Thursday night and Friday, there had been 8.5 inches of snow. and it was still melting off when we pulled in the driveway Sunday evening. And I had to call my sons earlier in the afternoon and say, hey, guys, can you guys get out there with shovels and shovel out the driveway? Because, we had a low slung car. And I'm like, I'm not sure we can make it in the driveway if you've got 8 inches of snow out there.
So, yeah, no kidding.
So they went out and they dutifully shoveled the driveway and got it somewhat cleaned off. And so we got in and was able to get back into the house. And, of course, in 2 days, it was all gone. Just like you said, because it warmed up here, just like it had warmed up in the north, because we were basically, I guess, right here along a river was the crossing of a front line, and there it was. But I really believe that there's not a whole lot to keep you excited in February. However, both at the state and the national levels, I think our politicians are trying to do a few things in order to make our Februarys at least a little bit more exciting. Now, I guess I take it back because I guess a few people were excited about some kind of a game that happened last Sunday, of which I had no interest whatsoever because one of the teams I really didn't know a whole lot about, and the other team happens to be one of the three football teams in the NFL that I can't stand.
Let me tell you something. You missed a football game if you did not watch it. Now, a lot of people will say...
I did not see a single snap of it. I didn't even watch the halftime.
You missed a football game. That was the I'm one of those people that's sort of like the Super Bowl's almost always a letdown. Their one team is so dominant that it usually doesn't mean anything and they're boring 28-3, that kind of stuff. Well, that
it's
was
funny you mentioned that score.
Interestingly, that was the score at halftime, and everybody said, including me, I said, "Well, New England's done.
Right, this game is over with because." 28-3 going into the middle of the third quarter, and then all of a sudden it was supposedly one of the greatest comebacks in at least Super Bowl history.
Well, it was. There's no doubt. Nobody has ever come from further than a 10-point deficit. Yeah.
Yeah, between the middle of the third quarter and the sudden death overtime, New England ripped off 31 unanswered points and won the game 34-28. There were reports of various people who were prominent New England fans who left in the middle of the third quarter thinking that they were done.
Yeah.
It wasn't going to happen. I read an article, Mark Wahlberg, the actor who's actually from Boston, he said he left in the middle of the third quarter. So, people were not counting that, Tom Brady and the New England Patriots actually are a fairly formidable team. I mean, any team that has their top-rated quarterback suspended for the first four games of the season and then uses a third stringer because their second string got hurt, uses a third string quarterback and wins three of the first four games and then goes on to win the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
You really have got to just get, as much as I don't really necessarily like the entire New England Patriots thing, they're Patriots. Well, I know, that's the whole thing. I've never been a big Tom Brady fan, although I got to respect the man's athletic ability. I certainly have never been a Bill Belichick fan, and that's not because I'm a Cleveland Browns homer either. It's just because I think he's dirty and he cheats. But you've got to just tip your hat. These guys put on a clinic.
Yeah, they
on
did.
how to make sure that you win a football game.
Okay, there was a play that I just simply run over back and forth in my head over and over and over because it was beautiful, and that was a play to a two-point touchdown conversion where yep. Brady lined up to take the snap, and just as it was snapped, backed away, and the halfback took the snap and ran it in for the 2 points.
Yeah.
That was a beautiful play, and I said, you know, that looks like the kind of play we might have run in a barnyard.
Exactly, sandlot football.
Yeah, it looked like sandlot football, and they pulled it off beautifully. I'll tell you what, I have no animosity to the Atlanta Falcons, and I have no love for the New England Patriots. However, I was rooting for New England for one reason. The whole Deflategate thing to me was nonsense. I, as you know, I'm trained in science.
Yes,
and the first thing that came to mind was on the whole Deflategate thing was I read enough of the report to realize that it was a railroad job. In other words, the whole thing about underinflated balls, well, let me tell you something. You take a football and you put it in a cold rain on a cold day, and it's going to deflate. It's going to have less pressure than it had when you started, when you pumped them up in a 72-degree room.
Right.
And you take it outside and it's in the 30s. It's going to deflate. It's why you have to put air in your tires when winter weather comes.
That's right.
Because it's the ideal gas law. PV equals NRT. It's all dependent upon temperature. The pressure inside the ball is directly proportional to temperature. Okay. That being said, with an N being a correction factor for, you know, the units you're using and that kind of thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. When I said I want to see Roger Goodell, who is a politically correct idiot, who is essentially destroying the NFL with political correctness, I want to see him have to hand the trophy to the owner of the Patriots. And suffer the ignominious defeat that he would have to suffer and to do that because he tried everything he could to make sure that New England didn't win another Super Bowl under Tom Brady. Guess what? He also had to hand over the Most Valuable Player trophy to Tom Brady. And if you watched it, you got to hear the boos when Roger Goodell stood up on the podium with the Vince Lombardi trophy and had to hand it to the owner of the Patriots. And you also got to hear the owner of the Patriots take a pot shot, veiled as it was, back at Goodell. But Goodell almost couldn't be heard over the boos, which I loved. I enjoyed that moment almost as much as the ball game. I don't watch NFL much anymore, precisely because it has become sort of a politically correct, namby-pamby. It got to be a game of freaks for so long that, you know what I mean, people that were just so unbelievably huge and, you know, thuggish. It had got into a kind of a thuggish thing for a while. So I don't want to watch it. It's not fun to watch anymore. I mean, I was a big Minnesota Vikings fan in the 70s. I still love the Minnesota Vikings. I always liked that old black and blue division when there was such a thing. It was Detroit, Chicago, Green Bay, and Minnesota. Those guys would beat each other half to death every week in these drubbing. I mean, it was rough and tumble.
The black and blue division, yeah.
Yes, the old black and blue division. It was rough and tumble. And when you played somebody in that old central division, you might beat them on the scoreboard, but they would beat you up, force you to spill blood to get the score. And you knew you had played an NFC Central team when you won in there. Well, you know, some of that's, you know, it's all changed. I've also been a Cincinnati Bengals fan. Well, look how that's worked out.
I sit there as a commiserator. Yes.
How many times can San Francisco beat Cincinnati in a Super Bowl? Well, that's
three.
Three. So far, three. Yeah. So, again, I haven't really watched. I had no idea what everybody's record was this year. I knew about the 4-game suspension, and I knew about Deflategate, which I thought was utter nonsense. So it was good. And it was an exciting game in that anytime you got a team that comes back in the second half to tie a score when they're down by 25 points in the first half, I think the tale was told in the second half when the Atlanta Falcons got driven out. They had worked their way down the field into field goal range and actually got driven back to the point where they couldn't kick a field goal. They would have had to kick a 57-yard field goal, which isn't going to happen with modern kicking techniques. That's not going to happen. And that was the play that I said, the defense is now awake on the Patriots side. And it was. They came alive. And Atlanta responded with what looked like desperation because they had done so well. Now things weren't working so well. The machine wasn't clicking so well. So having watched that, that's my take on the Super Bowl. I realize we don't do this show to talk about sports, so...
But you know what? Again, it's February, so it's a nice segue. And I know that probably a number of our listeners did watch that game. We talk about it because it does have some, you know, cultural impacts and influences on people. And the whole thing with, you know, is it cheating? Is it not cheating? Are there scientific or rational explanations for things versus, you know, are they just flat out lying about things? So they're getting that. Plus, you get some science involved. I mean, we are a multifunctional program here, Chuck. You know, you're giving them science, and we give them history and theology and ethics and economics. And you know what? We're just like a college course crammed into an hour on the radio Saturday. Isn't that cool? No. And I'm sure a lot of people are going to be going over our website. No. That's not – no. You're not doing that.
Yeah, we can tell them what our website is. It's www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com.
Yeah, come on out and give us a visit. Hear some previous shows. Go back and read some of the things that we've been writing, and sadly enough, we haven't been writing much lately, but that's going to change.
Yes, it
I've actually finally gotten a motivation to write, Chuck, so it's I'm going to start cranking some things out here. But anyhow, one of the things, again, like I said, February is kind of slow, but one of the things that is happening right now is that it's never too early, Chuck, because... next year, in 2018, about this time of the year, actually it's going to be a little bit earlier, people will have filed to run for the statewide offices in Ohio. The five, you know, the governor, secretary of state, treasurer, auditor, and attorney general will all be up for election. And this time around, all five of them will have to be open seat races because the incumbents are all... serving, they're finishing their second terms in those offices, and so you're going to have this mad scramble among people and politicos for who's going to be the nominee for the each party for these state offices, and that's already starting. You know, Chuck, I just spent my day at the State House. We're recording this on Thursday for Saturday, but I just spent my day at the State House on Wednesday, talking with a lot of people and hearing around the State House. You know, you hear the whispers and things about who may or may not be, you know, running for this, that, and the other. And two things are becoming clear right now. Number one, there is going to be a train wreck in at least the Republican side of the ledger in the primary for governor, because you've got at least four, if not five, different politicos who are gunning to do that. It looks like there may not be any primaries in the offices of auditor, treasurer, and possibly attorney general, at least on the Republican side, because it sounds to me like there may not be, and again, that can change depending on what happens, and that there will be probably definitely a fairly contentious primary for Secretary of State on the Republican side. Now, on the Democrat side, well, Chuck, just like at the national level, what you're hearing right now from the Democrats are crickets, because they really don't have much of a bench right now. I mean, yes, there are some leaders in the Democratic Party that are, you know, in the legislature right now that will probably be termed out at the end of this year, or the end of this cycle. And so they may go ahead and decide to keep themselves viable, or at least try to be viable, by running for one of these statewide offices. And that would include the minority leader of the House of Representatives, Fred Strayhorn, who's in his last term from the Dayton area. And, you know, Strayhorn, I don't know if he's going to run for anything or not, because, you know, by now, if somebody's going to run, they, because of the way our continuous political cycle works these days, they really have to be announcing, like, now, in order to get that early boost and go out and raise the money, so that when they get to a June filing deadline, which is what we have this June, all these candidates have to file their finance statements. And I know, talking with one of them yesterday, who has announced that they're gearing for one of those state offices, I was told that basically their goal was they're going to have $1 million in the bank by June, because that was their way of basically deterring other fellow members of their party from giving them a primary. You know, show strength.
Yeah.
And you know what? That's just classic. That's a classic move. Is, you know, if you come out very strong and show that you've got a lot of support, you can raise money, and you're going to have a war chest, that really does dissuade people who may be like, you know, I want to run for this, but I can't raise that kind of money. Because, again, even at the state level, you're looking at contests that may cost $3 to $5 million apiece or more if you're talking about the governor's race. That's really, you know, it's kind of obscene that you have to spend that kind of money these days for, you know, just basically putting a person in an office for 4 years to basically, you know, do really, to hopefully not do any damage. Let's put this way,
well,
to the state.
Okay, this brings up a good point, and that is... Okay.
Good, I'm glad you found one in that somewhere.
Well, in the presidential race, let's talk about this. The whole money, money is bad in politics. Money, money, money. Money's horrible. It's interesting to me that Hillary spent tons of money. I mean, wheelbarrows full of money from exceedingly questionable sources, some of them. Nonetheless, Hillary spent a wheelbarrow full of money. Donald Trump did not. He spent some money, and let's not kid ourselves. He spent some money, but he didn't spend anywhere near what she had to spend.
Well, and part of the reason for that was he had a Republican establishment in many states, including Ohio, who really were absolutely looking to have him not win.
Exactly.
And we saw how that worked out as the head of the Ohio Republican Party, Matt Borges, was dethroned last month and kicked out of that office by Jane Timken, because, in big part, because of the fact that they wouldn't lift a finger to help Trump, who's now the president. You know, that really doesn't look good on a resume.
No.
If you're a Politico, that you were heading up a party who basically refused to help your nominee, who then became president. That really, outside of the state and some of his, you know, long-term cohorts that he's collected chits from over the years, I don't see Borges making too big of a splash on the national scene.
No, I think he basically, he'll be somewhere in the background, but as far as the being the front runner, he's done.
Oh no, that's
no, he's the front office man. He's not going to get that job again.
Yeah. Oh no, that not for a long time. But, you know, you're right. You know, you've got all of these situations going on. And even at the national level, just like I was saying at the state level, the Democratic Party, I mean, they don't know what to do. They spent gaboodles of millions of dollars. Some say, I think, that maybe over $1 billion trying to get Hillary in as president. It didn't work. She lost. I don't care, and I hear these people, but she won the popular vote. No, she won New York City and L.A. County.
Right, right.
By wide popular vote margin.
Again, this is the beauty of the Electoral College. It's supposed to dampen out extreme results in limited geographical areas, which is exactly what it did. It dampened out an extreme result from California and an extreme result from New York and environs. That mm-hmm. is basically what it dampened out, and the fact is that it did its job, because despite what you hear about, I listen to a lot of old-time radio, and in the 40s there was a lot of talk about how we live in a democracy, and democracy is important because it does this and this and this and this. You know, a dictator can't take hold in a democracy. Oh, I laughed at that. I said, well, of course it can. The mass of people themselves can become a dictator. We live in a yes. republic, not a democracy. And what does that mean? It means that government is limited by law. In a democracy, government wouldn't be limited by law. It would be only limited by the will of the people and how well the will of the people had been manipulated by people who are at the top of the pyramid. And again, in California, you know, I'm trying to remember what the margin of victory for Hillary was in California. It was something ridiculous, like 65-35, something like that. And, you know, despite all the boo-hooing to the contrary, there were a lot of illegal votes cast. I don't think necessarily there were the 2.5 million margin that, in California, the 2.5 million margin to make it a popular vote win, but it's possible. One of the things came out recently about the in California, I think the head of the assembly in California talked about was it the head of the assembly talked about the fact that most of his family was illegals, and the part of the quote that I just read, and I've got to see if I can dig it up again, that the news media is not talking about is the fact that the guy said, and basically a lot of them vote, and they will not vote for people who stand against them. Well, how can you vote in a state where you're supposed to be a citizen to vote, and how can you get voting rights in California? You know, how can they say, well, he openly says that most of them have fake IDs and fake Social Security numbers. Well, what are they using? No, they're using that to get driver's licenses. And what happens in California when you register for a driver's license? You are automatically registered to vote. And we are now getting admissions that these illegals who have illegal identifications and illegal Social Security numbers now vote illegally. Well, does that come as a shock?
Oh, absolutely not. It shouldn't, at least.
Yeah. If it does, well, welcome to, you know, being deceived, because you are being deceived. It is illegals vote all the time. They're in fact encouraged to vote. In many places, it's basically we have adopted the problem here is that we have adopted a don't ask, don't tell policy on voting, especially in places where there are a lot of illegals and a very far left agenda, because they know that people who came here based on the welfare magnet are not going to vote right wing. This is the big lie that Republicans have fallen for when they come out in favor of Dreamer programs. They think that eventually they're going to win over voters who essentially came here illegally with not work as a magnet, but welfare as a magnet. Because let's not kid ourselves. A lot of people come here to have that anchor baby. And what do I mean by an anchor baby? Birthright citizenship, and suddenly you can't be deported because you're a United States citizen. Well, what's that say? Well, your parents can be deported, but you can. Well, who's going to stand? Who's going to sit here and say, well, the parents need to be reported, but the child can stay here? Who's going to be in favor of that? If you do, you're going to be basically painted as an ogre, and you might be a bit of an ogre. This is one of the problems with birthright citizenship and, you know, that particular issue. But the fact is that, you know, one of the arguments that I'm seeing against building a wall, and I'm not going to come out and say one way or another whether I think we ought to or not, but one of the arguments against it is that the wall of separation between Mexico and here is not the problem. People come here not because of jobs necessarily. They come here because of our welfare programs. When you make the welfare programs unavailable, a lot of people don't find the United States so attractive. And will openly say, well, I probably wouldn't come if you didn't have the quote-unquote safety, the safety valve. Why are we not ending our rather obvious problems with our welfare state? Because that's what's costing us a major amount of money. That's what's acting as a magnet. We have a fairly good economic picture. It's not been so great since 2008, but you know, we still have an economy that works, and people want to come in and take advantage of that. And unfortunately, what it means is the welfare state means higher taxes. There's no way around that. You can't continue to confiscate and redistribute wealth without higher taxation. And essentially, this is what you see in places, and not surprisingly, it goes hand in hand with the drive for the $15 an hour minimum wage. Well, what's going to happen with the $15 an hour minimum wage? You're going to have a lot of people.
There will be minimum employment.
And minimum employment. There are going to be a lot of people working under the table, which means no taxes paid. They're paid in cash. For much less than $15 an hour. And in fact, in places where it's heavily enforced, what's going to happen? We've talked about this before. It's going to mean automation. We talked about this a little bit last week. We've talked about the fact that people want to go to driverless trucks. What's the only reason to go to a driverless truck? So you don't have to pay the truck driver.
Right, so you don't have to pay the hourly rates and the insurances and the unemployment compensation and so on and so forth. But yeah, no, I get that, Chuck. I mean, and it's absolutely, but you know, you asked the question about, you know, why are we having trouble getting rid of the welfare state? Because that's the way you distribute money to get people to vote for you.
Exactly.
It's a vote buying scheme, and both parties actually don't really want to. I mean, some of them do. Let's be honest with it. Some, and I mean in both parties, I don't mean just Republicans, some of them understand the soul-deadening, initiative-killing, apathy-inducing effect of expanding the welfare state, and they don't like it.
Yeah.
And you know, you see things, people talking about personal responsibility and you know, personal investment. But really, most of that is just tinkering around the edges. It's not getting at the core of the issue. And you've seen some of those effects. I mean, you know, in Ohio, they did that where basically, you know, we had a perpetual welfare system for decades. And finally, the legislature got a hold of it and said, okay, now we're going to change the whole system up. And you can't be on it generationally. And it can't be just a continuing entitlement. You know, and of course, you know, they made these big changes, and people howled. And of course, the what I call the graft lobby, which is the organizations that are, you know, getting bank off of the welfare state, and there are a lot of them out there. You know, they act like they're the caring groups that they're trying to fix all these problems, but what they're really trying to do is figure out new and creative ways of getting the government to give them more money. And of course, the biggest way you do that is you get more people dependent upon the government. you put more people in the dole. You get more people. You figure out ways of getting people qualified for government subsidies. Hey, and in Ohio, what did our governor do? After we had done welfare reform and it was working so well, what has our governor done? They want to expand eligibility for Medicaid.
Yeah, he reopens the door.
Which is another government welfare program.
Yep.
And I mentioned I sat in that at the House. I actually was in both chambers on Wednesday, but I went over to the House Finance Committee to listen in because they're holding hearings on the governor's budget proposal. Yeah, it's that time of the year. Yes, February. That's the biggest excitement around the state capitol is the fact that the governor's executive budget has been handed to the legislature, and they now have an as-introduced bill. And I actually, this is Thursday. As of yesterday, didn't have a number yet, but the bill was being drafted and was going to be available, I think, either sometime today or tomorrow publicly. But they've been holding hearings already. They had the governor's director of the Office of Budget and Management, who helps put together the executive proposal, come in and talk about why they did it. Well, Chuck, his testimony was 57 pages long.
Wow.
Okay, that was a long, long, and this wasn't yesterday, but he came in last week. They also had the Legislative Service Commission, which is the nonpartisan group of attorneys, economists, et cetera, forecasters who work directly for the assembly and not for the governor. You had the OBM director, who is the administration's guy. Then you had the LSC director, who is the legislature's guy, both giving their budget projections. And, of course, LSC does a thing, and they call it the forecast book. Well, that was 61 pages.
Wow.
But they both testified, so that was a long day. And it was very interesting that you've got situations where you just look and, yeah, it's like, okay, on paper, it all balances out. Because, well, unlike the federal government, Ohio has this pesky little provision in its constitution that basically says that, number one, that budgets have to be in place for the upcoming fiscal year by June the 30th of that preceding year. So fiscal year 18 starts in Ohio on July 1st of 2017. And so they have to get the two-year biennial budget, which is for fiscal years 18 and 19, in place. They have to have it done by June the 30th. But then there's this other little catch. We can't run deficits in Ohio like the federal government does. Thank God. We have to have a budget that balances to the penny. Makes it a unique challenge for our friends in the legislature when they're handed a proposed budget by the executive that, although on paper balances to the penny, when you start digging into the meat of it, you realize how it balances to the penny is, let's move this out of the general revenue spending and put it over here in the special fund. Oh, you see all these repayments? Well, we're going to bump those back another year or two.
Uh-huh.
Okay, we're going to create this situation where you're going to have to raise taxes on people. Indirectly, though, because the governor's going to run on giving people a big income tax break. And I'll give credit, Chuck, they've been doing that, okay? And for small businesses, there have been a relief of tax on small businesses during this administration. As much as I really have not liked John Kasich, that's one of the things that he's done fairly decently. And so there's another large percent, I think it's like 17% reduction in the income tax. And then, of course, they do most of that by shifting. And instead of having seven income brackets for tax purposes, we're only going to have five. So a lot of that gets shifted because that pushes people into lower tax brackets, which means they get to keep a little bit more of their money. But it still means we still have a progressive income tax, which is not good.
No.
And not at all. But then the governor's proposal is, well, you're gonna fix this problem, and we're going to be able to give these people this tax break by raising taxes on things like the oil and gas industry and raising taxes on sales. Now, I'm not necessarily opposed to a sales tax, Chuck. I don't think it's necessarily a major problem, except when it's really you, that should be the only source of revenue. I mean, I don't think we should have an income tax in Ohio.
No, I don't think so either.
We're stupid to start one. And you can thank the governor, John Gilligan. And during that time period in the early 70s, you can thank a Republican-led Senate.
Yeah.
Who caved.
Yep.
Who caved and gave up and gave the income tax to Governor Gilligan to fund all of his liberal proposals in the 70s. And we've been stuck with it ever since. Now, as you notice, nobody's talking about getting rid of the income tax. Governor Casey certainly isn't. But what they are talking about is, well, we're going to shift the burden. Well, we're going to tax these industries. We're going to tax fracking, and we're going to tax we're going to tax sales. Well, that's a direct tax on the individual. And they're talking about moving sales tax up 0.5%. Doesn't sound like a big deal, but if you live in a county that the sales tax base, that's the state base, is moving up 0.5%, so it would be 6.75%, I believe, would be the net state level, and then whatever your county does on top of that. I mean, in some counties, like maybe Cuyahoga and others, you may be looking at a 9% sales tax rate, whereas in other counties, it may just be 7.5 or 7 or 8. So we're going to have this shifting sales tax, which means that depending on where you live, you may be faced more burden than somebody who lives across the street in another county.
Right. Not just in the county, in municipalities.
Exactly. I was just about to say, and municipalities can also add a piggyback onto that sales tax.
Yep.
And so therefore, what does that really do, Chuck? I mean, as far as that goes, what you really end up with, and I think this is a problem because of the mix of the taxes, not because of the sales tax by itself, but because of the mix of the taxes, you get people who live in areas like inner city urban areas who are going to pay more in sales taxes, which, and they're probably already in the lowest income bracket as it is, and so, you know, whether they're paying income taxes or not, the effect of an income tax reduction really doesn't have as much of an impact on them as it would on, say, someone who was making, you know, a mid-level salary somewhere in another community. And the people that you're supposed to be helping the most with, relieving the burden of taxes are actually getting more taxes. And when you talk about increasing oil and gas taxes, well, Chuck, is the oil and gas industry, especially the fracking, because you know they're trying to target this down. Well, this is the severance taxes for oil and gas industry for the fracking to clean up the environment. Is the oil and gas industry going to be the ultimate ones who pay for that?
No, of course, Barry. This is what it's amazing to me how many socialists that I've run into, especially young people, who have been told that, don't worry, we're going to tax corporations.
Right.
We're not going to tax you, we're going to tax corporations. And I always ask, okay, who pays corporate income taxes? And you know what they always say? Well, what they need to do is, what they want is a price fix on the other end. So what happens is it comes out of the salaries of the corporate execs. Does that ever happen? Ever?
No, because they just pass it along in the fee of the goods and services.
Exactly. The costs get passed along, and the part of the cost is the cost of salaries. Now, where do they usually end up cutting when they're taxed to the point where they can't make it in a given market? Do the white-collar workers normally pay the price? They will lose some white-collar workers, yes. Very often.
Yeah, there'll be a handful that go, but mostly it's going to be...
Who bears the burden? Blue-collar workers.
Blue-collar workers. And the service industries that serve their industry...
Exactly.
...are going to lose, too. So, if you're talking in the quote-unquote fracking industry, you've got all the pipe makers, the welders, the drillers, the oil services companies, the tanker haulers, the truck drivers. All of those people are going to lose. Now, who else is going to lose? Well, okay, you're talking about, ultimately, they're talking about two different taxes, one at the wellhead for like 4.5%, and then at the refinery or another 6.5%. So in other words, once they get that natural gas or oil out of the ground in Ohio from the Utica or Marcellus shale deposits that they're working, and they send it to the refinery, and the refiner refines it down into whether it's motor oil or gasoline or diesel or whatever else it might be, or they get the natural gas and they get it ready to come and fill up your tank with it in the wintertime. You've got at least an 11% increase in the costs of your per unit, because they're not going to absorb that. Why would they? That's not how you stay in business. That's not how you stay profitable. You pass along costs. When somebody raises your costs, you pass it along if you can. If you can't, you know, in some industries, they're not nearly as volatile, as you drive by a gas station and you see the prices change almost daily, because they're looking at futures and things of that nature, and the companies are making decisions on where to set their daily price points in order to make sure they don't lose money. The consumer is going to pay for that. And, of course, which consumers are going to get hit the hardest if you have a situation where the cost of, you know, fuel or heating for your home rises by at least 11%.
Yep. Well, it's not going to be the corporate execs who sit in the who sit in the offices. It's going to be Joe Blow, who basically is working, as the phrase goes, paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah. Well, and that's the funny thing, because, you know, again, and I talk around the State House, there are a lot of the members who get it. I mean, they understand that there is no way in heaven or earth that budget proposal that the governor handed them is what it's going to look like when they get done. There's just too many things out there that's going to cause them to balk against the governor. And honestly, they should, because John Kasich's a lame duck. One of the lamest of lame ducks, as a matter of fact. He's so lame, Chuck. I'm laughing because I just pulled up Fox News online, and of course we'll link to this, folks. But here's a lovely little piece from the Associated Press that just popped up on today's the 9th, which is on Thursday, as we're taping this. Basically, the headline reads, Kasich to newspaper editors, quote, "I want you to survive," unquote. Now, why would Kasich be addressing the Ohio Newspaper Association at their annual meeting, Chuck? Could it be because he's so loved their coverage? I mean, obviously, most of these papers went in the tank and endorsed him for president during the primary, right?
I don't know the numbers, but a lot of them did.
Yeah. And so basically, you know, he was using this as a stump to really kind of sidelong slap at Donald Trump. Here's how he put it. He goes, quote, "I'd like to stand for all of you who have real content." Why is he saying that, Chuck? Because of this whole situation about fake news and the fact that oftentimes it's the mainstream media who are leading the charge on the fake news. You know, that they're biting into the things, and we've talked about that before on the program. But here, you know, and he keeps on going. Here's this case. He says, you know, "Stand for all of you. For all of you who've decided in a really crazy, changing world," i.e. in the Trump administration, "that your point of view, your editorials, your writings, your articles are critically important."
Well, nothing like pandering to someone who you're going to need in what will soon be your failed bid for the Senate.
Bingo! See, there it is, folks. This is, again, I think on last program I talked about the fact that I label myself a civic enigmatologist because I show how puzzles are put together. This is part of the John Kasich puzzle. He is out there courting the Ohio newspapers because he knows full well that normally all of those newspapers, save maybe one or two, will probably endorse Sherrod Brown in a general or the U.S. Senate seat because he's the incumbent, because he's liberal, and because his wife happens to be a former editor and writer for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. But hey, that's, you know, not neither here nor there. But he's courting these guys now so that they will give him endorsements when he runs in the primary against the announced Republican candidate, Josh Mandel, who is the current Ohio treasurer. You know, Kasich's announced that he's releasing a book in April on tolerance and, you know, getting along in this divided country. And, you know, and he's been spotted. We talked earlier about, you know, when he went to the, he, as a surprise, he decided to go to the inauguration, but it was only so he could get himself a soundbite or a video clip. And of course, you know, that little Unite Ukraine banner he held up. He's been palling around with John McCain, and John's been taking him to all of these, you know, international symposiums on security and all this other good stuff. So Kasich's trying to carve himself out a niche that he's some kind of an expert on foreign affairs or whatever it might be, both in contrast to Trump and in contrast to Sherrod Brown. Kasich's big problem, though, I think, in this whole issue, and of course, he's now, and I thought this was the most funny part, Chuck. And I'm going to ask you, before I even read this, during the campaign for president, during his administration as governor, where has John Kasich been on the illegal immigration problem?
Well, I, as far as I know, he's pro-dreamer.
Exactly. He's pro-dreamer. Here's his comment right now, because during this discussion he had, the speech he had, I guess a point was brought up about this whole issue of sanctuary cities, because you've got Columbus and Cincinnati who are like now, because, you know, they're thumbing their nose at the Trump order about, you know, a ban on folks coming into the country from certain, you know, terrorist sponsoring countries. They're going to create sanctuary cities to protect illegal aliens from being deported. So here's Kasich, quote, "I think this is a bad, bad thing," unquote. "When people break the law, they need to be held accountable for something like coming in here illegally," unquote.
How can you be held accountable when you're basically, when you look the other direction and provide support and basically open welfare and food stamps and all kinds of things to people who come here illegally? How can you...
Okay. Well, Chuck, do our folks just a quick little favor. Explain in a thumbnail what being a dreamer is.
Well, what being a dreamer is that basically once you get over here and illegally, what happens is you're essentially given amnesty.
Exactly. It's amnesty for illegal aliens. It was something that the Obama administration came up with called the DREAM Act, in order to basically say, you know, that we're going to basically waive the fact that you came in here, you broke the law, and you came in here to this country illegally. As long as you kept your nose clean while you were here, we're going to look the other way on the fact that you basically were a lawbreaker to start with. But here's John Kasich now, and he's a dreamer. During the campaign, he was all in favor of the DREAM Act. Now, when people break the law, they need to be held accountable for something like coming in here illegally, unquote. Chuck, the reason why he's changing stripes on this is because his primary opponent, Josh Mandel, has basically spent the last 2 weeks becoming the poster child for making sanctuary cities illegal in Ohio, and has actually worked with a member of the General Assembly to, and they're getting ready to introduce a bill that would make it illegal for a city like Columbus or Cincinnati to shelter illegal aliens.
And I will make a prediction that if it actually gets to the governor's desk, gets through the other house and gets to the governor's desk, he'll veto it.
Oh, no, God, no, he can't, Chuck. That's the problem. That's the reason why he's trying to become a chameleon. He's trying to mimic so that there's not a point of difference between him and Josh Mandel. You know, Kasich's going to have a major problem because, you know, when it comes right down to it, by and large, depending on your definition of conservatism, when you look at the two men, Josh Mandel most resembles a conservative versus John Kasich.
Yes. Oh,
and
yeah.
We all know that in a primary, especially in the state of Ohio, a conservative is going to have a better chance of winning in a head-to-head race against a liberal.
I'm going to ask you a question real quick, and it involves another state.
Please do.
But, okay, when does Joe Manchin come up again for re-election?
I believe next year, if I remember correctly.
And it shows, folks, pay attention to Joe Manchin, who's the only guy that came over and voted for Jeff Sessions.
Oh, yeah. He's trying to change his stripes as fast as he...
Now, what does that have to do with this? This is the way the game is played. This is the way the game is played. You spent the if you are a liberal Republican, you spend the you get reelected, then you go as far left as you can get, until about halfway through your term, or maybe a little further when you're a senator. Then all of a sudden you had better come to the right, or you're not getting reelected. And that's what we're seeing with Joe Manchin, and that's all of a sudden what we're seeing with John Kasich. He goes from touting the GOPE Chamber of Commerce line on immigration, and the Chamber of Commerce line, all you got to do is pay attention to Bill Kristol. There was an article today that Bill Kristol came out and was talking about, you know, that illegals were good because of these lazy white people who now are working are in the United States. Don't you want an infusion of hardworking people to come in? And I said, what you mean is cheap labor, because that's what the Chamber of Commerce wants: cheap labor.
Oh yeah. Now okay. Let me go ahead and fine tune this just real quick. Kasich went on to say, beyond that, he says, I don't believe in sanctuary cities. Quote, I don't think we got to pass anything. Just let this all work itself out, unquote. In other words, I'm going to act like I'm opposed to these, but I don't want Mandel to get credit, and I don't want to see a bill come across my desk.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's saying. Please don't send me this bill.
Now, again, Mandel's bill has one other thing in it that I think is incredibly smart. And that is, it would make local officials in these sanctuary city areas civilly and criminally responsible for any damages or injury caused by illegal immigrants who reside in a sanctuary city.
Oh, good.
In other words, if you're going to harbor a felon, then when they commit a crime, you're paying the penalty.
I don't know if you heard or not, Dayton has withdrawn itself from sanctuary city status.
Yes, they did. They were small. Well, Nan Whaley, who is the... mayor of Dayton, is looking to run for governor.
I see.
And she can't be embroiled in something like this that may, you know, dim her chances. The word's out on the street that she's looking to run for governor. And so, okay, that's fine. But, you know, this is the whole situation now. It's funny because Kasich's really got a big problem on his hands, because, you know, he's also here, he's talking about this whole thing about, you know, we need to go out there and people need to spend more energy caring for their neighbors and getting involved in their communities. Well, that's great, John. You know, we'd like to, you know, but I think what's happened is he doesn't get it. You know, he's got an office of faith-based and community initiatives, and if he spent 5 minutes going around with people, he would find out that there are an awful lot of people who are spending energy caring for their neighbors and getting involved in their communities. But maybe it's not happening in Bexley, where he resides.
Well,
I'm sorry. I mean, sometimes the complete lack of connect with this guy just drives me crazy.
It's
but
difficult
really,
to deal
his,
with.
His whole deal is, you know, he's like, well, what about your neighbor? Who's looking after them? Are they going to school? Are they off drugs? Why are you thinking that somebody in Washington is going to fix your problem? Because they're not. They're not going to fix it. But somebody in Columbus is going to.
Yeah, that's, of course, is utter nonsense. Those are all local problems that need to be handled locally, not at the state level, not at the federal level, at the local level. Yeah, pardon me, folks. I am a small government person.
Yeah, absolutely.
Basically, I've been talking with people about this. It's very interesting that all these welfare things the state has walked in and taken over at great tax expense used to be done at much lower cost by churches.
Yes.
Much, much lower cost. Running hospitals was done at a much lower cost because churches weren't interested in making a profit. They were interested in doing the work that glorified Christ. And the same thing with welfare programs, the same thing with social issues like drug addiction. And, you know, because this is not new. Drug addiction has been around since the late 19th century. Cocaine addicts, opium addicts, that kind of thing. And the church did a much better job of working to end that kind of thing than the government has ever done.
Yes.
And you know what? I hate to do this to you, Barry. We're completely out of time. There's so much more to talk about this. There's so much more to talk about this. And we never did get to the Gorsuch's nomination. So
that's okay. I think it's still going to be around.
It'll be here.
Week, so.
It might even be more fun next week.
That's right.
That being said, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.